You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is currently accepting applications for Northern New Mexico Tribal Business Scholarships. These awards are for Native American students attending four-year undergraduate programs in business-related fields in or out of New Mexico. The application deadline is June 15th. For more information, visit lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. That's lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. Or call 505-753-8890, extension 115. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Erica Elliott. She is a physician here in Santa Fe, and she's author of the new book. It's a memoir called Medicine and Miracles in the High Desert, My Life Among the Navajo People. She will be speaking at Garcia Street Books on June 30th, that's a Sunday, afternoon at 4 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is such an enchanting and sort of fascinating memoir that starts when you're about 23 years old. You're pretty much fresh out of college. You applied for a job to teach in the Navajo Nation, and you get this job as a teacher. You had no idea what you were in for.
No idea. It was a total shock to me, and nobody prepared me. I didn't get a manual or a sheet of paper talking about Navajo culture, Navajo people, Navajo lands. And so I was completely ignorant, and I was in shock at what I found. And after the first week, I was ready to go home because I thought I'd made a very big mistake coming to the reservation to teach.
Well, one of the things, and you explain this really beautifully, is that there are cultural differences that you weren't prepared for. So you went into the class, I mean, and any teacher, like I was thinking, anybody who goes to teach fourth grade in any school anywhere, even if the people, even if the kids are of their exact same cultural background, it's still hard.
It's still hard.
But you went in there and made some mistakes that you had no idea you were making. What are some examples?
I stood in front of the class and I said, "Good morning, class. My name is Erica Elliott." Nobody looked up at me. Everybody looked down towards the floor, and nobody said anything. And I was totally flustered, and so I said it a little louder, "Good morning, class. My name is Erica Elliott." And then nobody said anything, and so I looked at my seating chart, and I pointed to one of the children, and I said, "You're Billy Begay?" And there was no answer. And then I pointed my finger and said, "Billy Begay," and he cringed as though I had shot him with a dart. And I didn't realize how many cultural blunders I was making. Every minute I made a cultural blunder.
So what were some of those blunders? Explain them to us.
Well, Donna Scott, my teacher aide, who's the sister, by the way, of the late R.C. Gorman, the artist, she explained to me all the mistakes that I made the first day. After I decided I wouldn't quit after all, because my father, when I called up, I said, "I'm coming home." And he said, "No, you can't come home after a week. You can't judge a place or a people after a week. Why don't you stay 3 months, and then if you're unhappy, then come home and you can find a job out here." So I really thought that I'd be going home after 3 months, but I talked to my teacher aide, and I said, "I'm so frustrated. I really want to go home. I think I made a mistake." And she said, "Would you like to learn about my people?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, let me tell you what happened the first day." She said, "The kids weren't talking to you because they don't speak English." And I thought, oh my God, I never even thought about that. And then she said, "They didn't look at you. For two reasons. They're shy. These are kids who are not public school kids. They're boarding school kids, which means they come from very remote areas where they don't see white people. And so they're incredibly shy. And also, looking down is a way to show respect. So when she started analyzing, debriefing that first day, I felt so ashamed that I had passed so much judgment on these children out of sheer ignorance. And when I pointed to Billy Begay and he cringed, she explained, in Navajo culture, you never point to somebody because that's like putting a hex on them. It's singling them out. And in Navajo culture, you never want to be singled out from the group. That's not something desirable. Whereas in white culture, you like to distinguish yourself, be different from the group, and have everybody look at you and stuff. In traditional Navajos, that's not their style.
And so you learned not to point, but to do a different kind of sort of signaling.
Yeah.
And you very quickly learned a few words of Navajo, went back into class, and everything changed.
Everything changed because Donna said, she said, if you really want to make a difference and have the kids open up to you, why don't you make an attempt to learn just a few words of Navajo and I'll teach you. So she started to teach me, and the sounds were so strange. There were glottal stops and guttural sounds like sounds that don't exist in the English language, and there's no way to write them. Now they've devised a way to write them, but in my day, there was no way. I had to listen so carefully to all these sounds, and each vowel had about 8 ways to pronounce it. And if you didn't pronounce it exactly right, then you were saying something different, and it could be something bad.
Which you experienced.
Which I experienced. I said something really bad to one of my students. I thought I was saying, come here, my relative, but and I didn't go up long enough on the vowel. Shik'e. There's 3 words that sound very similar. Shik'e, shik'e, shik'e. And to white people, that all sounds the same. To me, it all sounded the same. So I thought I was saying, come here, my relative. And I said something else. And the boy gasped and he ran out the room. And Donna Scott said, what did you say to him? And I told her, and she said, oh my God, don't ever say that. That's terrible. And then she told me what I said, which was, I think I'll skip it.
It's okay. You basically inadvertently asked a 4th grader to have sex.
Yes, I did. I didn't want to say it. And Donna Scott, she taught me how to say, good morning, my children. My name is Erica Elliott. What's your name and where do you come from? And so I practiced and I looked in front of the mirror and I practiced way into the night. The next morning, again, all the students were looking down at the ground, and I walked in and I said, and everybody's face looked up in total astonishment. This is the first time they made eye contact with me, and after they got over their shock, they laughed hilariously. They thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever heard. I'm sure I pronounced everything wrong, but it broke the ice, and that was marked the very beginning of falling in love with the students, with their land, with their ceremony, their homes. It was such a profoundly impactful experience. It was life-changing for me, what happened.
You were there for 2 years, and those are 2 very formative years. I mean, 23 to 25, you know?
Right.
And you were really, because you, and it sounded like kind of unlike a lot of the other teachers in that school, you were so genuinely open and, as you say, in love with these people, the children, their relatives, the whole culture, the land, and you were invited to do a lot of things that I sort of was thinking that might not happen today. You were invited into ceremonies, you were taught to weave Navajo rugs, and you were really let in.
I was totally let in, and it was like one miracle after another, what I witnessed, and the book is about all these miraculous things that happened. The children wanted so much to teach me Navajo that we made everything into an English lesson. The principal somehow let me get away with putting aside all the textbooks, the Dick and Jane type textbooks that the kids couldn't relate to. And these were kids in the fourth grade and still couldn't speak English. I'm sure they couldn't relate to the teaching materials. So we made our own materials. They wanted very much for me to learn about their lives. So I taught them English, they taught me Navajo, and in their desire for me to understand their lives, they started learning English so fast. It was unbelievable. By the end of the year, I entered many of them into an English contest at many farms down the road, and three of my students won first place. And these were kids who couldn't speak English.
And they were literally speech contests.
Speech contests.
Yeah.
I still have the newspaper clippings. They were so on fire, meaning they were so lit up because they wanted me to know about their lives, about their family, about their sheep, about their clans, their witchcraft, all that stuff, the canyon, the land they live in, their ceremonies. And so they learned English very quickly.
And one of the things that taught me as I was reading your book was that, I mean, it's something that we all know if we really think about it for more than 5 minutes, which is that learning takes place, it's a relationship.
Yeah.
It's not a commodified thing, you know, yeah. And I'm sure there's some people who learn through online learning, but when you're a child that age, they had to like you.
Yeah.
And you had to like them, and there had to be an exchange. So you were giving them so much, they were giving you so much, yeah. And you both knew it, and yeah. That's how the learning took place.
Yes, there was love. I mean, I loved them so much, and they knew it. They knew I was crazy about them, and they used to clamor for me to take them home on the weekends. And how this first started is Billy Begay, the guy who cringed when I pointed at him, he happened to be the boldest guy in the class. And shortly after this breakthrough of learning Navajo, he came up to my desk. He didn't speak much English then, and they called me Ellet. E-L-L-T, because it was too hard to say Miss Elliot. So they said a one syllable, Ellet. And so he came up to my desk and he said, Ellet, take me home. I said, take you home? He said, oh, which means yes in Navajo, oh. And then I looked puzzled, and then he said, check me out. Oh, you want me to check you out of the dormitory, like on the weekends? And he said, oh. And so that's what I did. I filled out paperwork and checked him out, and he took me way deep into the canyon. And we had the best time with his family. We raced horses bareback on the bottom of the canyon, and they totally accepted me, and they spoke only Navajo. I didn't understand much because I was just learning Navajo. But, you know, when they laughed, I would laugh. They thought I was hilarious, so they'd laugh at me, and then I'd laugh, and then they'd laugh more. And pretty soon we're all bent over laughing, and I didn't have a clue what we're laughing about. But it was amazing. And then every weekend I checked out a different student, and we'd go to their homes and go to their ceremonies that white people have never seen, don't go to, and aren't allowed. And they totally took me in like I was one of them. It was so deeply moving.
To the point where, I mean, there's a couple of moments in the book where you realize that you were kind of being groomed to marry a Navajo man.
Yes. Yes, I was taught weaving and how to make fry bread and how to butcher a sheep, all with the idea that I was going to marry a Navajo man. And I was making myself a good wife for a Navajo man.
Which I have to say, you might have done had you been a little older.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, Marshall, Tom, he really pursued me. And he was twice my age. He was the founder of the Navajo Times newspaper. I ended up falling in love with the land where his parents lived, his ancient parents. And I wanted so much to spend time there that he made a suggestion that I retire from teaching school and just herd sheep. And because then he said, then you'll really live like a Navajo and learn the culture, and then you'll get really fluent in Navajo, because they only know one word of English, and that's water.
Right. So you actually did that, and you spent a summer, several months, like 3 or 4 months, being a sheep herder this family.
I had 594 sheep and goats, and the grandmother, who was about 87 years old and still chopped wood and rode horses, and she was amazing. She was very strict. So I learned everything from A to Z. And so when I wove rugs, it was from the herding the sheep to shearing the sheep to carding the wool to spinning it to dyeing it to weaving it. So a rug represented a lot of that went into it, not just going to the store and buying yarn. It wasn't like that.
Right, right. And at that point, you really did become more and more fluent in the language and the culture. And something that really seemed to help was that you were very strong.
Strong, yeah.
You ran and you could butcher a sheep.
Right.
And one time you were in a kind of assault situation and you outran your assailant.
Right.
So you brought a lot with you.
Right. I was very strong physically. I always had been. I had rock climbed with my father and hiked. And plus, I always had this feeling, I don't really know where it came from, that I had to prepare myself for something really big. I had to make myself, my mind and my body strong, but I didn't know what for. And after a mountain lion sniffed me when I was lying out on a redstone rock in my sleeping bag, a Navajo grandmother said that the mountain lion came to me because he was my spirit guide and that he came to lend me his focus, his strength, and courage. And because she said I would need that for what lay ahead, she said I would face some very life-threatening challenges, and if I survived, she said, I would have powerful medicine for the people. I wrote that in my diary and then forgot about it, but somehow the message was implanted at me that I would face something really big. I didn't know what it was, and I found out later. So,
what was it?
Well, there are many huge challenges that almost took my life. One of them was a snowboarding accident that caused brain damage in me. And
that was quite recent.
Yeah. And then I was injured by chemicals in 1991 at a clinic where I practiced medicine. And that's what propelled me off of mainstream medicine, which really wasn't why I went into medicine to give out pills. In fact, the Navajo word for Anglo doctors is azeshini, which means he who gives out pills. And that's not really the purpose of my life. So getting poisoned by chemicals actually forced me to find my true purpose in life, which was more helping people heal and being their allies.
You went through a number of ceremonies and you witnessed things and even did things that were very hard for you to understand at the time, and are really hard for anybody to understand. In one of those ceremonies, you were able to speak and understand Navajo really before you could.
Yes. Yes. That I had only been on the reservation for about a month or 6 weeks. I was in Fleming Begay's eating chili stew. That's the only restaurant in the area. And a guy came and sat down next to me, and he had just graduated from college in the Midwest, and he wanted to make conversation with me. He was so excited that I was trying to learn Navajo and everything. He said, I want to take you home to meet my family. And I said, I'm not looking for a boyfriend. And he said, no. I just want you to meet my family. You know, forget the boyfriend stuff. And so he took me to Black Mountain, and we really hit it off with all his clan. It's a huge extended family, the grandmothers and the... They call your cousins or your brothers and sisters. So you had a huge amount of brothers and sisters. And I kept coming back. I really liked it there. And his mother said that she was going to adopt me unofficially. And she said that they were my Navajo family. And so she said that she wanted to confide in me, that she belonged to the Native American church, which is peyote. And she asked me if I would like to come, even though it was illegal for white people to attend those in that era. And so I said yes, and even though I was scared, because I knew it was plant medicine that changes one's psyche. And then she told me I had to take off my white man's clothes and put on the Navajo outfit, which I did. It was so pretty. I have a picture of it. I look like I'm going to the prom or something, a Navajo prom. And then when we were sitting in the peyote ceremony, again, I only spoke a few sentences in Navajo and that's it. So when the sacred tobacco came around to each person, they took a puff and then they exhaled it and they said a prayer and then took another puff and exhaled and then passed it on. And so when the sacred tobacco was about to come to me, my Navajo mother whispered, "You can pass it on." But I took it and I puffed on it, exhaled, and then I started to pray in Navajo. And then I inhaled and exhaled and passed it on. And then I thought, oh my God, I just prayed in Navajo. I prayed in Navajo. I prayed a prayer I've never heard of before. How is this possible? I must be hallucinating. I must be so high on this plant medicine that I'm creating a reality that's impossible. And then it got even more intense because then the water drum came around. And again, my Navajo mother said, pass it on. And I took it and I started chanting the peyote song and then passed it on. I thought, oh my God, what just happened? How is this possible? This must be a dream. I'm going to wake up from this dream pretty soon. And I'll realize this never happened. Finally, the peyote wore off. It was morning time. And we filed out of the hogan. And we touched our forehead with the earth and blessed ourselves with the eagle feather fan. And then we went into the cinder block house next door. And where breakfast was laid out on the floor, a big sheet. And then the canned peaches and mutton stew and so forth and fry bread. And when we're sitting there, the roadman, that's what you call the people who lead the peyote ceremony, roadmen, as opposed to medicine men, which is for the traditional Navajos. Peyote has been borrowed by the Plains Indians. It's not their traditional way of healing. So the roadman started talking to me nonstop in Navajo, and he's looking right into my eyes and talking. And I felt really, like, uncomfortable, and I said, I said, you know, I don't really know what you're saying. I don't speak Navajo. And everybody laughed so hard. And then he said, you really talked up a big storm last night. You were praying and singing in Navajo. And oh, my God. I thought, no one's ever going to believe me. I can't tell anybody. They're not going to believe me. They're going to think I made this up. So I thought, okay, this is my secret. I'm going to keep this a secret.
And did you pretty much keep it a secret
Yes.
since then until this memoir?
No, I kept it a secret for quite a few years. And then when I was in medical school, I was with students and we're feeling really congenial with each other and sharing personal stories and stuff. So I let my guard down and I started telling one of these healing stories where I had instantaneous healing of what's probably a cancerous mass, like a lymphoma.
Yeah, that's another ceremony story.
That's another ceremony story. So I let down my guard and I told this story. And the reception I got made me realize I mustn't tell these stories because nobody can believe it. Then I got older and then I didn't care if people believed me or not because I was telling my truth. And if people couldn't handle it, that's okay. So I outgrew that fear that I'd be judged as making up stuff. But then I couldn't tell the story because I was so caught up in medicine. Once you're in medicine, it's so time consuming. And
Western medicine,
yeah. It's very time consuming. And so what made me finally write it is the elections of 2016, which was so disturbing to me. And I thought, now's the time to tell my story, because my prayer was that this story would be an antidote to these divisive, hateful times.
Just briefly, that tumor story was you had this tumor in a lymph node on your neck, and it got bigger and it got harder and it really scared you. Mm-hmm. And you went into ceremony.
Yeah. I first went to Western doctor. I drove an hour to Sage Memorial Hospital in Ganado, and it was very scary for me. The hospital smelled like disinfectant. It was lifeless. It was cold. And the internist showed up in his white starchy coat, and he listened to my story and felt the node. And he said, well, this doesn't look good. It looks like this is cancer. You need to come back and we'll schedule you for a biopsy and further testing. So I was so scared. Like many of my patients are, they're so scared when they get these pronouncements. And so I told Donna Scott, my teacher aide, and she said, oh, I know just the medicine man for you. And she told me how to reach him. She said, you cross the wash and then you turn right at the sagebrush and then two pinyon trees down to go left. It took me all day to find the guy, and he was out herding sheep. He listened to my story. Then he said, I'm sorry, it's not my specialty. And so then he told me about a Hopi man. So then I spent another day trying to find this Hopi medicine man, and he said it wasn't his specialty. So now I was totally despairing. So I went back and told Donna Scott that these medicine men said it wasn't their specialty. And so she said, well, you need to ask your family to do a ceremony in the Native American church. And so they agreed to do that, but they shared it with a sick baby because it's expensive to put on a ceremony. You have to butcher sheep, and sheep are like money in the bank for Navajo. So when they were praying in there, my focus was on the kid who was sick, and I was watching to see if the kid showed signs of getting better, and I completely forgot that the ceremony was also for me. I completely forgot. I was so earnestly praying for this kid and chanting. And then at the end, in the morning, when we filed into the cinder block house and had our breakfast, everyone sat there and just stared at me. And I didn't know why they were staring at me. And then suddenly my hand flew up to my neck and the tumor was gone.
So now here you are, a medical doctor. How do you understand what happened?
I can't understand. I can't explain it with Western medicine. I can only say that I'd have to look for higher physics, quantum physics, to explain something disappearing like that. And it still, for me, defies true understanding. To tell you the truth, I don't know. All I know is it happened, and I can't really tell you why. I can only give hypotheses how that's possible. You can change matter like that.
Has that experience, because there were several experiences like that over the course of your life that had to do with ceremony, especially back in that time, has that affected the way you think about medicine, about both the power and the limits of Western medicine?
Yeah. I left Western medicine because it seemed so limited, because patients are affected by one's belief system. And if you have a very narrow belief system, then they'll believe what you believe, that certain things are not possible and that you have to do things a certain way or you're going to get in big trouble. So I already knew that wasn't true, even when I was practicing Western medicine. I felt like a bit of a fraud in Western medicine because I didn't believe a lot of what I was taught. I felt like it was driven by industry.
So the not believing what you were taught, was it like what you were taught was wrong or it was incomplete?
It was incomplete, and some of it was downright wrong.
What are some examples of what was wrong?
That everything had to be treated with drugs. That's totally wrong. But we were so brainwashed. But I was older. I was 10 years older, so I was harder to brainwash. And I had all these experiences, which I knew were true.
One of the things that was interesting to me also about your time in the Navajo Nation was that people believed very strongly in werewolves and witchcraft.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that you kind of didn't believe in. And so, like, for example, when it was hot, you would sleep outside and they'd be like, no, the werewolves are going to get you. And
yeah.
And they didn't.
No, they didn't. And one little boy said, I said, should I be scared of werewolves? And he said, well, they're not interested in Billigana, the white people. And I said, why not? And what he said was so profound. He said, because Billigana don't believe in them.
Right.
And so they don't exist. Is it? I mean, that's amazing. You see what you believe in.
Yeah. It reminds me of a story, and I can't remember exactly where this was, but it was sort of, I think, the Spanish conquest, where the Spanish came and sorcery didn't work on them because they didn't believe
yeah,
in sorcery.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like voodoo. If somebody puts a curse on you and you believe in it, you will die. But if somebody does that to me, I won't die because I don't believe in it. I saw that happen in mainstream medicine where doctors would make pronouncements about people. I had a very profound experience watching a guy who was told that he would die of very advanced cancer. He had a chest x-ray. They didn't have MRI scans when I was a beginning medical student. And so he came in for a cough that didn't go away, a lingering cough. He was a big, hulking, healthy guy. And so the x-ray showed this huge mass, and the doctor came in and said he didn't have very long to live to get his affairs in order, but to come back so that he could do further testing. He never came back. And within 3 months, he was dead. The wife was so shocked because she said he went in with a little cough, and then after he left the appointment, he was not the same. He was pale. He looked like he was dying, and then he died. So she asked for an autopsy. There was no tumor. No tumor at all. Then they went back to find out because this was a big deal, and they had read the wrong x-ray. He died from words. It's like voodoo. He had voodoo.
It was somebody else's x-ray.
At somebody else's x-ray.
Tumor.
It's like the doctor inadvertently had done voodoo on this guy. I saw the life leave this guy's face when the doctor made his big pronouncement that he didn't have long to live. I saw something leave, like his life force leave this patient's face. It went white, completely white. That's how voodoo works. You believe something bad's going to happen, or conversely, something good's going to happen. With this guy, his system just starts shutting down.
Extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. This is something I witnessed in Western medicine.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of voodoo that's being practiced by doctors.
A positive outcome of that was after you left the Navajo Nation, you went into the Peace Corps and you went to Ecuador. And that's another story that you could have written a whole other book on, and maybe you will. And you were in a town, not even a town, a little village where nobody had ever seen a white person. They didn't even know if you were male or female.
Right.
And at a certain point, they decided that you were, they called you La Patrona, the boss. They decided that you could help them in ways that you didn't know how to help. You were a young 20-something with no medical training, and they brought you 3 sick babies.
Yeah. So they thought I was some kind of priestess or something with all kinds of powers just because I was white, and the only white person they had seen was the Catholic priest from Spain who had left. So after they got over their fear of me and started coming around, yeah, they brought 3 sick babies, and they begged me to heal their babies. And I kept saying in broken Quechua, they spoke broken Spanish, and I spoke broken Quechua, but somehow we could communicate. I told them that I was not a doctor, and they didn't care. I wanted to help them so badly that I did something crazy. I went to my first aid kit and took out an aspirin, smashed it up into little tiny individual grains. I gave each baby a grain of aspirin, a grain. It's like a grain of sand. I mean, that does nothing. And gave them each. And then I made the sign of the cross because the priest had taught them Catholicism. And I made up a prayer in Spanish.
On the spot.
On the spot. Like, may God cure, que Dios le cure pronto, and stuff like that. And the mothers came back a day later, 2 of the mothers, holding a stick of roasted guinea pig, because that's what the only protein they ate, and they saved that for ceremonies like weddings and stuff. They each had a stick of a guinea pig for me to eat, and they said their babies were all completely healed.
So how did you understand that at the time?
I didn't even know the word placebo.
Yeah.
I did not. I just knew something happened. I have to figure out what happened. So I just was so determined to try to find an explanation. How can a grain of aspirin heal something? And then I realized it has nothing to do with the aspirin. That's when I realized that the mother so believed in me, it was something was being transmitted to the babies, the mother's belief that I could heal the babies.
Because it was, I mean, if you think about the placebo effect, you think about the patient having a belief, but a little tiny infant
right.
isn't going to have a belief.
Right, it's like a dog. You think, can you do placebos on dogs? Well, I think it's somehow the mother conveyed something to the baby, a confidence that the baby received somehow. Otherwise, you know, I don't really know how to explain this at all. But then everybody started lining up.
Right.
And
which must have been so much pressure.
It was awful because most of the time nothing happened.
So right.
I couldn't recreate that situation.
And somehow, because they'd seen the miracle or whatever the first
yeah.
time, then they believed in you whether it worked or not.
Yeah.
Like no amount of negative
right.
evidence to the contrary
right.
was going to deter them.
Right. They still lined up even though they didn't get results. I mean, some got a few results, but nothing like the babies.
Very interesting. One of the things about your time in Ecuador that was different from your time in the Navajo Nation was that because your experience, or at least the way you were, that I read it, your experience here in, you know, Arizona and New Mexico was so profound, it was almost like, I can't go through that again. I can't give my heart in that way and then leave.
I couldn't, yeah. I felt so awful when I told my Navajo grandparents that I was leaving. The conversation was so painful. We were out in front of the cabin and it was in the evening and I said that I'm going home. And then there was a silence because they don't talk very much and they don't mind silence the way white people, it really seems to make them uncomfortable. They could sit for ages without talking. And so, but then they said, well, your home's here. And I said, well, this is my mother and father. And then long silence. Where do they live? And I said, New England. The grandfather said, where's New England? And I said, this is all in Navajo. I said, near the great water where the sun comes up. And then there's a long, long silence. And I just felt so bad. Like somehow I had misportrayed myself or something. But all my Navajo friends treated me as though my life began with them because
yeah.
they never asked me about my past. They never even knew I had brothers and sisters. They didn't know I had parents. It was almost like, okay, she dropped down. She's with us now, and this is her life. And so it was a total shock when I said, I'm going home. And I felt so rotten that I made a commitment to myself that in future situations, I would make it really clear that I was only there for a certain period of time. Like I said, I'm here for 2 years, I'm in the Peace Corps, and then I'm going home to my family and stuff. And so I found I did not put myself so deeply into their culture because I didn't want to hurt feelings. I didn't want to and hurt my own feelings because it ripped me apart when I left the reservation. I was ripped apart. Because I could have stayed there, married Marshall, had children, stayed there the rest of my life, but I was too young. I needed to find my purpose in life. I always knew that I had this purpose. I didn't know what it was. But being with the Navajos really opened my eyes to part of my purpose, and part of my purpose was service. And it profoundly moved me that just caring about somebody could make such a huge difference in their lives and in my life too. So I was always getting closer and closer to knowing what my purpose was, but I didn't know what vehicle that caring needed to be translated into. And it was medicine, but not Western medicine.
So you got trained in Western medicine.
10 years practiced in Western medicine, and then I practiced my own form of medicine, which is very eclectic.
Which we can talk about in a moment, but what was interesting was you then, part of the way you got your medical education paid for was to give back in quote-unquote
right.
underserved communities,
right.
and you went back to Navajo.
Right, I did. So when I realized, when I finally had this epiphany that all this time was leading towards medicine, I told the advisor at University of Colorado in Boulder that I wanted to go to medical school. He didn't take me seriously at all. He said, look, you know, you have everything against you. You don't have any money. You just came back from the Peace Corps. How are you going to pay for it? You're too old.
29.
29. And I said, 29's too old. He said, well, you'll be in your 30s when you get in. And I said, well, I'll be 30s anyway, no matter what I do. What difference does it make? And then he said, you're a woman. And I said, what difference does that make? And he said, well, it makes it harder. You have to prove yourself more. And then he said, you have the wrong background. You have a liberal arts background from Antioch College. Anyway, I got in against all odds.
He was a poop head.
He was. He told me, afterwards, when Stanford wanted to interview me and they sent me a letter, I brought it to him, and he said he apologized that he tried to stop me from applying, and he said, I was just trying to do you a favor because you said you had no money and it's very expensive to apply to all these schools, and you have to go buy a suit to be interviewed and get your hair done and all that stuff.
Oh, God.
And so anyway.
Talk about, that's what they call a can't-do attitude.
I know. It's incredible. But that's interesting because it has just the reverse effect on me.
Right.
And so what he made me do is made me try harder because he said I couldn't do it.
And many people are discouraged by that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's good you weren't.
I was not discouraged. And I told him when I held up the Stanford's request for an interview, I told him that it's best not to discourage somebody who has a vision of what they need to be doing. I said, I suggest you not stand in their way, you know, because they know what they need to do and they'll find a way. And I did. I found a way. And the University of Colorado said that they would take me right away because I said, I have to go right away because they all say I'm too old. And so they were very generous with me. They said, we want you. They said, we have one concern though. We're worried in the admission committee, we're worried that you will just do your medical training and then go on to another adventure because your whole life is one adventure after another. And I said, no, all that adventure was trying to find my purpose. I found my purpose. This is my purpose. And so they said, okay, we'll take you and we'll pay for the first 2 years. You'll get a full scholarship. All your needs will be paid for. And for the last 2 years, the National Health Service Corps will pay for your education, but you have to pay them back in an underserved, under-resourced, understaffed, underfunded clinic. And you can choose, but it has to fit those requirements. So I chose Cuba, New Mexico, because half my patients would be Navajos.
And when you talk about understaffed, under-resourced, nobody could imagine how bad it was.
Oh, my God. It was actually, before I came, it was a fantastic clinic because there were five young, eager, devoted doctors there. And there were tons of EMTs, physician's assistant, nurse practitioners, and so forth. But unbeknownst to me, all five of the doctors walked out in protest for Presbyterian Medical Services budgeting cuts. They said they couldn't do their job, that they were couldn't practice good medicine because they didn't have the supplies and stuff. And they needed more supplies, and yet they were getting less supplies. And so one of the doctors that left realized, oh my God, this new doctor doesn't know. So he called me up and said, you know, I've got some really bad news for you. You're going to be on your own there.
And what was really, I mean, when you think about it, five doctors couldn't deal with the load, and now they were putting it on one doctor.
Yeah, and then one fill-in doctor who was just there part-time. It was It was unbelievable. It was a nightmare. I was doing stuff that I hadn't been trained to do. I was not trained in emergency medicine. I was trained in family practice. From the moment I walked in the door, it was one emergency disaster after another. My first patient was a medicine man who had been run over by an intoxicated person in a truck, and he was dead on arrival. And all the relatives were saying that I needed to bring him back to life. And so, I mean, I had a tube in every orifice. I was doing things that I had never learned before.
And they didn't even have the tubes. You had to use a ballpoint pen.
A ballpoint pen like they did in Vietnam. I mean, I can't believe that I made it through those 2 years.
And at a certain point, you said, I'm going to hurt somebody because I'm so sleep deprived.
Yeah.
And they still didn't care.
They still didn't care. They said, I called Washington. I said, I'm in desperate. I can't stay here. You need to assign me to someplace else. And they said, no, they couldn't. And I had to stay there because they couldn't get anybody to come there. Nobody wanted to serve there. And I said, what if I quit? And he said, then you'll owe the government three times the amount because of interest and all that stuff, or you'll go to jail. I said, are there any other ways I could get out of it? And he said, well, you could declare insanity. So I thought about that anyway, but I stuck it out.
And toward the end of that time, the Navajo people whom you served as a doctor decided that they wanted to do a prayer ceremony for
right,
you.
Right.
And part of it was, the prayer ceremony was that you stay there for many years to come. And you were like, no, don't pray for that. Like, what do you want us to pray for? Peace and harmony.
Yeah.
They didn't, that was too abstract.
Yeah, that was too abstract. But they said, we'll pray for whatever you want. We'd wanted to pray that you'd stay here, but we'll pray for whatever you want. And I said, besides, I have to leave anyway, because UNM had asked me to be assistant professor to in their training program. And I asked them, why? I'm only 2 years out of my own residency program. You want me to be assistant professor? And they said, yeah, your 2 years in Cuba is like 10 years someplace else or more. And you're a woman and we're looking for women role models. After I accepted the job, I ended up having to decline it because of something wonderful that happened, which you'll have to read the book to find out.
Oh, okay.
But I'll just tell you this. In the circle, in the peyote circle, all these people were praying fervently for what they interpreted as peace and happiness. Peace and happiness was too vague for them, so they put it in their own terms. They prayed for me to have a baby, land, home, and a husband in that order. And you'll have to read the book to find out what happened.
Let us tease our listeners by saying that prayer works.
Prayer works. That's why I was so desperate to change the original prayer. At first, I didn't realize what they'd said, but after I realized, oh my God, they're praying that I stay here. And I saw how powerful prayers are. So I knew I had to stop that prayer immediately.
So you then have had a long life in medical practice, and you practiced Western medicine and still use Western medicine, but you've also, as you said, made a more eclectic practice. Before we go, can you tell us a little bit about what you do now, besides write memoirs?
Okay. I try to do whatever works. I don't follow a certain dogma. I do some Western medicine. I mean, I use drugs when really nothing else would do the trick, but my whole focus has been from day one to find out the reason the person is sick. Is it from grief? Is it from mold exposure? Is it from Lyme disease? Is it from bad diet? Is it from eating foods you're allergic to? Is it from toxic fumes from a brand new carpet or something? I try to get to the bottom of it. I really don't like treating just people's symptoms and not addressing the underlying cause. Sometimes we can't find the underlying cause, but I think it's really important to try. And I use herbs. I send people for ceremonies. I sent years ago a patient to a medicine man, and she got well from her chemical sensitivities. That medicine man is dead now, but she went all the way to Canyon de Chelly to find the medicine man, and she went three times and got well. It was amazing. So I draw on everything I know. sometimes try hands-on healing. Sometimes I talk to the patient long enough, I can find that they're dealing with huge amounts of grief, huge amounts of trauma. So my whole thing is to be the patient's ally in helping them find a way to heal themselves.
Erica Elliott is a medical doctor. She's author of the new memoir, Medicine and Miracles in the High Desert, My Life Among the Navajo People. She will be at Garcia Street Books on Sunday, June 30th at 4 in the afternoon here in Santa Fe. Now, this is the first of four memoirs?
Yes.
Do you want to preview the others or should we wait until you write them?
I think you better wait.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, one of them is about my son, and it's going to be called How My Son Raised Me.
Very interesting. Well, Erica, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I love being here.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank Flannel Foundation for their support. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.